Well, yesterday you and I went on a bit of a journey to the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, but today we are going to the coast where the mangroves and wetlands provide a hugely important ecosystem. And as the world slowly warms and sea levels rise, there are questions about what it means for these vital areas. Neil Saint-Alain is a world-leading earth scientist whose research has changed our understanding of how coastal wetlands work and respond to rising sea levels. He's recently been recognised for his work, winning the Australian Academy of Sciences Mawson Medal. And I'm delighted to say that Professor Neil Saint-Alain from Macquarie University is my guest today on Changing Australia. And Neil, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Sally, and to your listeners.
Now, we're going from one swamp to another, out of the budget and politics, into yes. actual swamps. You grew up next to a mangrove swamp. What kind of world was that like for you?
I was very lucky. I grew up on the shores of the Georges River here in Sydney and had a mangrove swamp in my backyard. So much of my childhood was spent exploring and canoeing on the river. And I haven't gone far from there. I still live down that neck of the woods and do get into the mangroves occasionally.
Well, we have something in common. I'm a kid who grew up amongst the mangroves on Spencer Gulf in South Australia, on York Peninsula.
Yes, fantastic.
What did you see as a kid when you were wading through the water, occasionally getting stuck in the mud?
I just remember them as being the most peaceful places. You know, I'd slide my canoe in there and lie down, and the sun would be coming through the trees and the water would be lapping at the canoe. You'd see fish swimming around, and it was just a very, very restful and beautiful place. And I think some of that sort of stayed with me. I just always felt this connection with these incredible places, and I've had the privilege of travelling around the world and seeing magnificent wetlands all over the globe.
Do wetlands get the public love that they deserve?
They do now more than they used to. You know, when I was growing up, it was pretty common for them to be filled in for housing estates, and no matter how much housing pressure we have, it's good to have these natural places. They're pretty well protected in terms of coastal wetlands. They're well protected in Australia. So it's very uncommon now to see them being cleared and converted into other types of land use. But one of the challenges is inland, our freshwater wetlands. Of course, there's a lot of competition for water. And it's more difficult to protect them by just sort of putting boundaries around them, because they're linked in many ways to the catchment and things going on, you know, elsewhere.
In what way are the wetlands a bit of a canary in the coal mine for the broader issues and urgent challenges that the environment is facing, Neil?
Yeah, so coastal wetlands, mangroves, tidal marshes live in a very sort of narrow elevation around the tide. So if the tide is increasing in height, sea levels are rising, then that's going to have an immediate impact on mangroves and tidal marshes. And that's sort of the main area that we've been looking at. How much sea level rise can they cope with before they begin to fall apart and we lose these magnificent forests and tidal marshes?
What does the data tell us about what's happening?
Yeah, that's been really interesting. So there's two ways of looking at this. One is to go back in time, because sea level has changed in the past. And in fact, after the big ice sheets melted off the Northern Hemisphere, off North America and Europe, there was really quite rapid sea level rise. And one of the encouraging things is that we know that the species that exist in these wetlands did manage to survive sea level rise in the past, but we don't find evidence of the big forests, the big sort of massive scale wetlands that we see around the world today. So they survive more as individual species, little pockets, opportunistically, you know, taking advantage of different locations. Something happens around a tipping point of 7 millimetres a year of sea level rise. And that's a number that's coming to us from a whole lot of different research, looking at the past, how they've operated when sea levels have been changing in the past, and also looking at the globe today, because some places has higher rates of sea level rise because the land is sinking. So that gives us a bit of an insight into what might happen in the future. And if you pull all that data together, it comes always to this same number, not just for tidal marshes and mangroves, but also for coral atolls. Mm. Once you get above 7 millimetres a year of sea level rise, things change really dramatically, and you start to see the failure of these systems. They have to start retreating landward, so you're losing what you have. And the important thing for us to understand is that at the moment we're not at that tipping point. The rate of sea level rise globally is around 4 millimetres a year, but we're moving up toward it. And the projections are that between 2 and 3 degrees of warming we're going to cross that tipping point. We're currently at about 1.5 degrees of warming globally. We're trying to keep under the Paris Agreement warming below 2 degrees. If we tip above that, current projections in terms of national commitments to reduce emissions has us at about 2.7 degrees, so it's in that danger zone. And so this is another bit of research that's saying, come on, let's keep to these commitments. Let's try to keep warming below 2 degrees, because we tip above that, we're moving into territory that's very, very dangerous for these magnificent coastal environments.
We're talking about these environments as very important places for the wider environment. They make a big contribution if we let them do their thing.
Oh, absolutely. So, number of things. I mean, biodiversity, they are sort of hot spots for ecological diversity. They're important for migratory shorebirds that are doing their migrations, for, you know, in Australia, crocodiles, fish, fisheries productivity. So they're really important for animals and refuges for a whole range of biota. In the tropics, and this is where, you know, you get economists that calculate the economic value of these systems. In the tropics, they protect shorelines from storms, because the waves have to propagate through these big forests and it saps all the energy out of the waves. They protect these soft sediment coastlines. So they're really important in coastal protection. And then finally, and this is something that's emerged out of research in the last 10 or 20 years, they are the world champions of natural carbon sequestration. So they're taking carbon out of the atmosphere. They're building their root masses. By the way, that's one of the ways in which they adapt to sea level rise, by building these huge root systems, and that sort of pumps them up a little bit in elevation. And they're taking carbon out of circulation. So there's a lot of interest in replanting, restoring, managing these systems to allow them to do their natural thing of helping us solve the climate crisis, taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and storing it below ground. And that's what we call blue carbon. The blue comes from, you know, the oceans. These are marine systems that are one way in which we can help solve the issue of climate change.
If you could wave a magic wand and make some changes to ensure we don't get to that 7 millimetre rise, what needs to happen quickly?
Just all the things we're committing to. You know, I mean, Australia's been, I think, doing well in terms of thinking about energy transition. It's about solar energy, it's about wind, it's about battery power, it's about transitioning away from fossil fuels. And that's happening, you know, across the globe, because these new technologies are the cheapest form of power generation. So we're on the right path. That's why I have hope. You know, I don't think we need to despair. I think the economics is in our favour in terms of energy transition. It's going too slowly. There's no question about that. And it's disappointing to see some world leaders, you know, think of people in the United States, for instance, who are stepping back from some of these climate commitments, based on what I think is a really poor understanding, both of the sort of ecological and societal consequences of climate change, but also the basic economics. You know, where are these economies going in the future? What are the industries that are going to be profitable in the long term? It's all around this innovation and change around renewable energy. So we want to be behind that. And personally, you know, just sort of be thinking about how you can lower your carbon footprint. Doesn't mean you don't use power, but you use it in a more sensible and, you know, economically viable way.
You know, it's been so valuable to have you on the program this morning, and also evoking memories as a kid growing up in the mangroves. Lots of mud and exploring. We used to have a kayak, which would have two of us and the dog, and then we towed my little brother on a surf ski, and we used to make him sing as we crossed the deep channel to make sure that he was still there.
I've got a whole group of friends. We go out kayaking twice a week, and I'm building a little team of citizen scientists, mangrove ecologists amongst my sort of Oatly kayak club friends. So
wonderful.
Just a shout out to them.
It's a great place to explore. Neil, thank you so much for being my guest this morning.
Well, lovely to talk to you, Sally.
It's Professor Neil Sainteland there, an earth scientist at Macquarie University, recognised quite rightly and acclaimed for his work in this area, in coastal, in wetlands in particular. If you've got a suggestion for changing Australia, send it in. You can do so on abc.net.au/changingAustralia. If there's someone in your community, one of the groups that you belong to, your business sector, send those names in.